Hi again, and welcome to How to Ruin Your Own Reputation, the show where I talk to people who either have unusual jobs or are living lives that some people don't quite understand. Today, you are going to meet Phyllis Taylor, also known as the Prison Lady. For 20 years, Phyllis taught technology to hundreds of lawyers and support staff until her life took her in a very different direction in front of a very different type of audience. She was doing motivational workshops for inmates at several different penitentiaries. This led to her writing her book titled The Prison Lady, and in it, she shares her experiences and the lessons she learned from the people that she met. And I loved her book. I found it very easy to read, but very engaging. My favorite part was hearing about the people that she met, because truly, we cannot understand how anyone else lives until we speak to them directly, and Phyllis got to do that. So let's just jump right in. And I'll say, welcome, Phyllis. Thanks for coming on How to Ruin Your Own Reputation.
Thank you, Marcy. I know you know how honored I am to be with you this evening.
Well, it's been a long time coming, so I'm excited. The first thing I want to ask is this. I want to know how it felt the first time you walked in to the room to talk to these people who were incarcerated. How did you feel?
So can I back up just for a second to talk about the very first time I arrived at the prison and then go to that?
Yes, absolutely.
Because my very first time in a prison was in Metro East, and there's a whole lot of coincidences and, as I say, beshert or divine intervention as to how I got there. But just arriving at my first prison, getting through the control desk, meeting with the gal who was interviewing me, I have to say that the moment that I arrived and walked inside those walls, and remember, from a posh law firm to, you know, a prison cell, it felt like I had arrived. I just felt like this is my calling. This is where I want to be. Huh. This is where I'm meant to be. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That's how I felt. Going into, now I'm going to say you're asking about my first experience in a prison. It was at Metro East as well. And the first time that I worked with prisoners directly, they brought in, this is a detention center. There's a difference between a jail, detention center, penitentiary. I won't get into all of that necessarily. I'll just answer your question at the moment. But in that instance, they had brought in four men, threw them up against the wall. They were shackled. They were chained. They were patted down in front of me. I was awkward. They were fine. We were in a guest cell, so an interview cell, where they had, you can imagine, as in the movies, a metal table and four chairs clamped to the cement floor. So I get a chair, because I'm the older lady, and the four prisoners are going to alternate chairs. Well, let me tell you, I was there to teach anger management. That didn't work that well, but the musical chairs, that was great. The respect and just the attention and all of the way that they were handling me and treating me and my connection with them, like instant. It was just, words can't describe. It was a blessing. And it was, again, another reinforcement of, you can do this. You are where you belong.
So you spent 20 years in sort of the corporate world, and then you go into this situation, which you were not planning. This wasn't something that you had planned. And yet you're saying that this was where you felt you were meant to be. What do you think it is about maybe your past or just about who you are that led to you feeling so comfortable in that situation?
So I had spent 30 years. You've got the 20 right, but I'll just clarify.
Okay.
So I spent 30 years at my former law firm, which I call McBillion. And 20 of those years, which is where the 20 comes from, I was teaching lawyers. The other 10, I was a paralegal and then teaching lawyers. So that's where. Ooh. And so I went from teaching lawyers to teaching prisoners. And your question is, why prisoners? Why did that feel like a calling? Do you know what? I can tell you that as a child, I was abused and I was locked up for a year. And I can say that perhaps that contributed to my level of empathy, but nobody really knows for sure why they feel that they've arrived. But I can also share with you that from a very early age, and really annoying to all of my husbands, that every time I would go to Italy and I'd be at the train station, they'd have to wait for me because I wanted to interview the guys there who were involved in alcohol abuse. And I always had this like, oh my God, can I help you? I'm interested in you and I want to help you. And that hasn't gone away. And I think it's innate. I really think it's innate.
Did you fight it? Because you didn't, if that's been your calling, you didn't go into social work or anything like that. You went in a completely different direction. So why do you think you did, why do you think you zigged instead of zagged?
So, you know, that's a great question. When I was working at the law firm, and I have to be totally brutally honest, 20 years of teaching lawyers, was it? Am I allowed to say fucking good career? Because that's what it was. Anything. So it was a fucking good career, which meant, not literally, but it did mean that I was totally and completely respected. And I had spent a lot of my years trying to climb into a space of respect. And here I am like, holy cow, you're not just a paralegal, you're actually teaching these guys. It felt good. It felt comfortable. I loved my career. I was defined by my career. But when things happen, you take a turn and you look around and you think, what else am I going to do? And if you recall from my book, it was an inspiration that I got from attending the Oprah Winfrey life class when she came to Troy. So it wasn't like all of a sudden I woke up one morning and went, prison, sounds good. I like smelly places. What happened was I went to Oprah and they'd Skyped in those six women from the penitentiary in Indiana. And so in listening to Bishop T.D. Jakes, Yolanda Vassant, Tony Robbins, those were her guest speakers, speak to these women, I was studying them until I literally slapped my knee, lunged from my seat and went, holy fuck, this is what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. I am going to be a motivational speaker in a prison. It was that simple, Marcy. It was that simple.
So the people who knew you well, were they surprised because you're making such a change, or did they know you well enough to say, oh, what took you so long? Like, this is totally the right thing for you.
You know, I had a spectrum of people who believed in me, supported me, and if she's going to do this and she's explored how to do it and why she's doing it, they believed in me, they supported me. Those people still are. But then I had what I call the scaredy cats who like are afraid to move out of their shadow, are afraid to make a move of their own. And that gets projected back. And I had friends who were afraid when I went on an online date. I mean, they were faking until I got home. I'm talking girlfriend. So these same scaredy cats, as I'm going to aptly name them, were the people that said, you're going to a prison? And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, and I'm going to have them love me, and it's going to be just fine.
Wow, so you didn't have a doubt. There was no doubt that this was what you were going to do, and you were going to be successful at it.
Not even a tiny bit of a doubt. Not ever, ever, ever. And I did have a reversal, because that very first prison really bombed. And as carefully explained in my book, it was because it was a detention center and the guys, and it was men, and the guys in there are really nervous because they have been convicted but not sentenced and not classified. So these guys know that they're going to be locked away for a very long time, but they don't know whether it's 6 months. They don't know whether it's 6 years, and they're nervous, and they're certainly not wanting to pay attention to me. So despite my beginning and my Lori Shank, who gave me a chance at that prison, it really didn't work out well because they weren't really able to pay attention. Again, good at the musical chairs, but I had no doubt in myself, in my own capacity. Remember, I've been public speaking since I was a kid. I've been competitively speaking since I was a kid. I decided to be a motivational speaker and chose prison. It's just such a good mix for me.
But how did you know what to do? How did you know when it did work? So your next experience, how did you know what to talk about? How did you know what they needed?
You know, all of that was kind of intuition. That just great questions, because I went home and I thought, now if I were a person who was having it, and I mean, I was teaching technology, so nothing to do with any of this. So I just went home and I thought, you know, if I was a person who was sentenced to prison and I needed some life coaching, which I hadn't even begun to dabble in at that time. What do I need to know? And so I wrote out a list and I had, you know, the real easy stuff, forgiveness, gratitude, anger management. Well, easy to come up with the topic, intentional happiness and building a healthy relationship. And what else do we need to know? Like, that would be it. So then I picked my topics and then I began to write, because I gave each person in my class a booklet. And so I would write a booklet a week in advance of my class so that I'd have it ready for publication, so to speak, for every lesson. And so I was writing and writing and writing. And I mean, thank God for journalism, because that's my discipline. I studied at Ryerson. So I could write, I could research, I could kind of think what they needed. And you know what? When you go in and you start teaching it, you bend it and twist it towards your audience. And then you see the light bulbs go off and the questions and the connection and the wanting more. And like, you know, there's never been a doubt to this moment.
You talk about how people felt safe with you and people felt that you were really kind of a safe place to share stuff with that they couldn't share with other people. That's a gift. And the fact that you felt so comfortable in that environment is pretty amazing. Did you find that there's a difference when you're dealing with the men and the women?
Oh, yeah. So I have worked in a total of five Ontario prisons, one women's, four men. Each prison has its own culture. It's almost like each church or synagogue has a culture. Each hospital has each entity, and they all have their own rules, their own guidelines, their own training. I was trained to be a volunteer five different times. I was screened. I mean, it felt like I was going undercover for the FBI. But the prisons are different. And in four of the prisons, I was working with men. And so it isn't like men versus women, but it was like this prison versus this prison. When I worked with the women, I worked with in both general population. So I would do a Tuesday afternoon shift in general pop. And then I would go out. I'd have dinner across the street at McDonald's. It was an ice cream cone. And then I'd come back and I'd do another shift with the women in protective custody. So we're talking about murders and statutory rape and all that neat stuff. So it's really hard to compare, because each individual is unique. Each story is unique. But I have to tell you, I chose men over women because I ended up with a permanent gig in a prison that is called the Ontario Correctional Institute. This prison lives in Brampton. During COVID, it was cleared out because of it was in the paper. They had 60 outbreaks of prisoners, 20 staff. So they had to take all my guys out of that prison and put them in Maplehurst, which is also known as the Hurst. And that's in Milton. So, and that's the prison I'm actually going back to next month. But what's important to know and what I want to share is that in order to get into the prison in Brampton, it's known as a rehab-centric prison. And the guys that go in there apply through their lawyers to get there. So they have heard that they get a lot of classes, they get gym, they get education, and they get food that's decent. However, in order to get into that prison, they have to give up, in most cases, any chance of early parole.
Ooh,
that's a biggie. And they also have to give up any time off for good behavior, time earned, time off for good. Yeah. So they're giving it up to go to the Ontario Correctional Institute, where they're going to have an opportunity to turn their lives around. So these guys want me.
Mm-hmm.
This is where I can make a difference. These guys are really hanging off the edge of their seat going, oh, you mean I can forgive myself? And it's just like magic in there.
That brings up such a good point, which is, if you're saying that there's, out of all the prisons that you went to, and I know from speaking to former inmates, other prisons as well, most of them do not have that rehabilitation factor. They don't have that, which to me seems almost criminal in itself. The fact that here you have people saying, no, I want that. I will give up any chance of getting out early if I can get a chance. Because I guess if you go through a program like yours and other kinds of support programs, when you do get out, the chances of you making it on your own are so much better if you're given the skills and the support that you need. And I know from reading your book that you've seen people who were in jail who had the best of intentions, who just weren't given the opportunity to do better. And a lot of them, and I know that you said this with the female prisoners especially, and I know from a former female prisoner that I spoke to, a lot of the women are in there because it's situational, because of abuse, because of sexual assault and drug issues. And had they had the support at the beginning, they wouldn't be there. But had they had it in jail, then they would have a better chance of coming out. That must have been very frustrating for you.
It's 100% what you're saying. There are, in my opinion, there are two factors that contribute to reducing recidivism. Number one, so, you know, I in all the time I've been in this prison, I've seen one gal return once. But that aside, and shamefully, which was sad for her, but that aside, the two factors that contribute are rehab in the prison. My prison, as I call it, the Ontario Correctional Institute, is the only rehabilitation-centric prison in Ontario, perhaps further. Why? Because of money, obviously funding. And the second thing that contributes to lowering the recidivism and successful outcome is if they have a support system on the outside. So if they are being released into, oh my God, where do I go? I've got a bus ticket to get home and it doesn't even take me from Milton to Toronto. And I've seen, and women have told me, and I have seen it happen, where the cabbies are lined up outside the prison because if they get a blowjob, they'll drive the girl home. So they're already, we're talking about prostitutes. They've been in prison for prostitution. Yep. And they're going to prostitute themselves for a ride home. So the system has set them up for failure from the time they get on the other side of the gate. I don't know if you recall, but Manny, in my book, I believe I did call him by his first name, spent 10 years in the Kingston Penitentiary twice. Sandwiched between Paul Bernardo and David Milgaard, came to the Ontario Correctional Institute, met me, became my assistant, friended me as if this has to happen because I'm going to make a difference in my life now. We became friends, stayed friends. He's on the outside now, and it made a difference, a real difference. I don't want to give away the farm, but he's a great story, and he's got a great ending. So that prison and rehab works, and our system is setting these guys up to fail. And one more thing I want to add, because I love this,
of course,
is about to your question, is I had a guy, he was in there for brutally abusing his wife. When his prison term, I will never forget this elderly Greek man, when his prison term ended, I mean, they all talked to me. He came up to me and he said, I'm getting out on Tuesday. This is my last day with you. So I go Monday. He's getting out Tuesday. This is my last day with you. And I'm congratulating him and giving him a pep talk and giving a top up and all of this stuff. And he says, I don't want to go. I don't want to leave prison. I have come so far. And he credited me with your classes. He said, I just know that if they would let me stay another 6 months, I'd get there.
Oh.
He begged to stay.
Oh,
they would not let him. Wait. And there's another guy. And I know what this does to people. And there was another guy who, one of the rare ones, they were going to let him out on early parole because his behavior was exemplary. And he refused early parole and decided to stay. And stayed for an additional 6 months and came out like a winner. That's a guy that, again, he came back as a social worker.
Wow.
Yeah. It's kind of wow, isn't it? That's how it I is, feel. I just feel amazing.
Well, you know, I had posted once before I was doing a show about prison, and there are some people who have very strong feelings negatively because their lives have been impacted by violence. And I remember a few people saying, well, why do they deserve a second chance? Nobody deserves a chance. Prison shouldn't be for rehabilitation. It should be punishment. And even if you're getting rehabilitated, it's punishment. But I will say this, not everyone does deserve a second chance. Not everyone does deserve, but there are evil people out there who, given any chance, an opportunity, will do bad things again. However, there are so many people who do deserve the chance. And I think that we're doing them, but also ourselves, on our society disservice by not giving them the chance, because what they do when they get out, that changes whatever has been done and they've been punished for, then they contribute positively. There was something else that you wrote in your book that will stick with me forever. You talked about a woman who also you had bonded with, and she was working with you. And I think she was getting out, but she said something, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm paraphrasing, but she had said, like, you could trust her in prison. You could trust her with anything. But if you saw her on the outside, she said, do not trust me.
That's Trucker.
Because it's different. And to me, that's, I've never heard anything. Can you explain that a little bit more?
So in every prison, one of the really nice aspects was, I mean, it was better than the law firm. In every prison, they gave me an assistant. And so this person was responsible for helping me find my auditorium room, because it's a massive place and I'm directionally challenged. So they would help with that. They would help me set up my equipment. Often I was bringing in my own projector and all that kind of stuff. They would take attendance, hand out, all of that. So you are referring to the gal in the women's prison who I fell in love with. Her offense was prostitution. And she's known in the book as Destiny, not her real name. I'll save that for private conversations, but she's also known as Trucker because that was her workplace preference, was in a truck, was where she preferred. Okay. And she shared all this with me, and she was a beautiful soul and a very talented poet. But she also became, like every other woman and every other man, I'm going to say, quite frankly, my friend. Mm-hmm. This one rose to an even higher level because we had lots of time together. And when she was leaving the prison, she said, can we go somewhere private? Her idea of private is the laundry room. So together we toddle off to the laundry room, and there's people, I mean, they're coming and going. I don't know what private is in a prison, but the people are toddling in and out, and she sits me down. And so she said, I need to tell you something. You're very nice and you're very kind. She said it like an insult. You're very nice and you're very kind. But you are so trusting, and you need to know that everybody in here is clean and sober and with you, but never, ever trust us on the outside. If you bump into any of us, including me, we could be high and we could be dangerous. Stay away. And I've stayed in touch with her. Which breaks rules. I'm not supposed to, but it breaks and I don't care.
We won't tell anyone.
No, don't tell a soul, but I'm in touch with three in a decade, and no apologies. And she is one of them. Her story has a magnificent ending. And you know what? I just, like, if I can offer support to her, even if it's a Facebook, I haven't actually seen her, Marcy. I have seen the others, but even if it's a Facebook texting message and she knows somebody's here who cares, who's listening, I'm in. I'm all in.
Well, it goes to prove the point that a person isn't necessarily bad because they've done bad things. She's speaking for herself, even saying in this situation where she's safe and she's in good condition, then she could be a better person. But if she's in a situation where she's in danger, where she has to fight for her survival and she has to do whatever she has to do to get there, then all bets are off. So just proves the point that if we have what we need, and I think people who we just are naturally lucky enough to be born into situations where we have the basics, we can't imagine doing, let's say, quote unquote, bad things, but we also can't imagine not having those basic things that attribute to our behavior.
And what that does to your psyche and the desperation that you would have that will drive you to places that you did not even think possible or that you're capable of. And I don't think that, I'm trying to think of her book name, Destiny, ever did go back to heroin or any of that stuff. I don't think she did, but she didn't trust herself. That's what she was saying to me. I don't trust any of us, including me. She's a very special woman. By the way, she was born into a biker home. Her mother gave birth to her, decided, I don't want to be a mother, left her in a biker home. She was left to fend for herself. And I mean, how is that going to work for you?
Even Manny, I know, remember when you talked about Manny, he's also, as a child, he saw some pretty horrific things that nobody could get away from unscathed and untraumatized. So that's exactly really what I'm saying. It's very difficult to judge people. No, it's very easy to judge people, but we really shouldn't judge people without knowing their full story. Speaking of that, as open-minded and as open-hearted as you were from the get-go, we all have sort of preconceived notions before we go into any situation that's new to us. What would you say, if you could think of any big surprise that you had from the beginning of your journey, sort of being more into it, what surprised you either about jails or about people or any of the experiences?
The biggest surprise, if I could call it a surprise, is going to be heartfelt because that's how I'm centered. And the biggest surprise is how much I loved these people. And I mean love. I felt love. And, you know, we love different people in different ways, but I definitely felt love. And even more shocking was how much they loved me.
It's just hard to hear about people who really want help and we can't give it to them. Listen, I'm still reeling a bit from hearing about Destiny and thinking, okay, she was in jail for prostitution. And I'm like, that seems wrong to me. Just that seems wrong. You mean couldn't she have gotten support and help because she was driven to prostitution? Like that, I'm still stuck in that. I mean, I think I'm frustrated. So I can't imagine you having been in the system, seeing it with your own eyes and falling in love with these people who so desperately needed help, but also wanted help. And that I think is the hardest part is when, like anything, if somebody's going through something, they always say the first step is admitting you have a problem and you need help. No, it's not. Sometimes the biggest problem is getting the help. Regardless of what the problem is, you can, when you finally get to the point where you're like, no, I'm ready to make a change, help me. And they're saying, well, and we have people who want to help you, but we just don't have the budget or it's just not part of our plan. That's very incredibly heartbreaking.
Good point, Marcy. It's not just the awareness. It's the ability to move that awareness forward by actually being able to get the help. Like, what if I say to myself, you know what? I've got a problem with anger. I need a psychiatrist. I live out here. I don't live in prison. I need a psychiatrist. Well, what if I don't have $200 an hour?
Well, I say that all the time with addiction too. I mean, there's a lot of times when you admit you have a problem. I knew for myself when I was dealing with my eating disorder many, many years ago. And yes, I could get help right away if I was willing to spend $10,000 a week. Or if I remember calling one place and they said, sure, we can help you. But the waiting list is years and years and they couldn't get more specific. So any kind of problem, when you get to the point where you want help and you've got people like you who want to help, but then there's a system that is keeping you from getting the help. That's really, really frustrating. But that's why I love your book too, because I think your book, it's very easy to read. It sounds weird to say, but it's an enjoyable book to read. But at the same time, it's really giving incredible insight that I think is very important. And you're not preachy. You're very much, this is me. This is my experience. This is my story. These are their stories. You don't sugarcoat anything. And I love that. And I think it's so important. Before I let you go and you know, tell everyone again where they can get your book, and we're gonna post it in our show notes, is there anything that you want to say that you haven't had a chance to say before you go?
Yeah, you asked me to speak. I'm going to speak. Here's what I want to say to people. Here's what I want to say to people, Marcy. If you have a dream, if you have a calling, if you have somewhere where you think that you could help out in society, help out with humanity, do anything outside the box, Don't let anybody get in your way. Don't let anything get in your way. Believe in yourself and go for it. For me, it was kind of an easy path because I had some things happen to me that just kind of rolled into place. There's other people it'll be more challenging, but just like you right now, right here, Marcy, with your podcast mm-hmm. and all that you've accomplished, like, yahoo, go for your dream yes. and do yes. not let the doors stop you on the way.
Absolutely. That's a great message. Okay, so where can people find your book?
Well, you can find it at Indigo. You can find it in Chapters, and you can also find it online at Amazon.
And you're gonna it's called, again?
The Prison Lady.
Oh. There you go. The Prison Lady mug you're holding up. Perfect. And I highly recommend this book. And anytime if you can catch Phyllis Taylor talking, I suggest you do that too. Thank you so much for chatting with me. It was really such a great topic, such an important topic. And thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you, Marcy. Have a great night.
And you too. And thank you everyone for listening. And I will see you next week on How to Ruin Your Own Reputation. Take care.